All right, so I'm going to be giving you a talk about some experiments that we've been doing with a new model system that my group has been developing over the last 2 years. The basic idea is contained in this cartoon, which is these little shiny balls are supposed to be synthetic gold nanoparticles or polymer spheres. And to them, what we imagine doing is attaching single-stranded DNAs, which are these little squiggly lines. And if we do this in such a way that the ends of the blue squiggly lines and the ends of the red squiggly lines have complementary Watson-Crick base pairs, then we could imagine that when we mix the particles together, the red and blue particles together, they would form these little DNA double helices that would tie the particles together. And maybe we could use this as some sort of cockamamie scheme for driving colloidal crystallization or assembling some sort of desirable structure. Now, the one sort of caveat that I like to make a big point about is that if this binding reaction were irreversible, then I would just make some sort of gel. Okay, it would never be able to form any sort of ordered structure. So it's actually critically important that these things be dynamic, that these things sort of reach out, transiently form a bond, exert some sort of force on each other for some period of time, but then sort of rupture to allow annealing and then maybe reform again. And that's what I call handshaking. So in case you don't know anything about DNA, DNA has the virtue of being a heck of a lot simpler than proteins. So even though the protein folding problem is very hard, the DNA helix formation problem is very easy. You know that these two single strands can form a double helix based if they have a complementary Watson-Crick sequence. What you might not know is that this process is reversible and can be done any number of times. And for most sequences, I can actually model this as just a two-state reaction. Okay, I have a double-stranded state and a single-stranded state, and there's some delta G, some free energy difference associated with that. And as you might expect, that this state has higher entropy, and this one has lower enthalpy. So this is the low-temperature stable state, and this is the high-temperature stable state. And I can define a melting temperature where they're 50-50 in equilibrium. Now, this delta G hybridization gets even better. There's actually an empirical model, okay, called the nearest neighbor model, which has 10 free parameters that were trained on some sort of empirical data set, and it will actually allow me to predict what this hybridization free energy is for any arbitrary sequence. Okay, and there's a lot of other associated tools that I don't have time to get into. So the good news is that I can just play with sequences and I can make a combinatorial library of different molecule pairs that will react only with each other and not with other non-complementary sequences, and I can tell you exactly what the reaction thermodynamics of those of that library of molecules will look like. And the chemistry is easy enough for me to do it. So this idea was not my idea. It was first stated by Chad Merkin and Al Vassados back in 96, and they used it to sort of glom gold nanoparticles together. My lab made some sort of, you know, poor-looking colloidal crystals back in 2005. More recently, people have made very spectacularly nice nanoparticle crystals using this method, and these are, you know, I think small-angle X-ray scattering patterns, if you care. But then people have been doing a lot of interesting things with this technology since then, and this is all by way of introduction. So now what we want to do on my agenda here is I want to create a new class of model systems for soft matter. Okay, I want to sort of say, okay, by sticking DNA on particles, we can create a much more versatile and interesting and dynamic set of model materials. And we're going to use the fact that these interactions between my different species of particles are specific in the sense that I can specifically control which of these species bind to which other species by playing with the sequence. This binding process is reversible. It's temperature tunable. I can make it strong or weak by playing with the temperature. And there's also this whole field of DNA nanotechnology, which you might have heard of. And so I could actually take some of that technology and steal it and put it in here if I wanted to, although I haven't done that yet. So the essential thing you need to take away is that if I have n particles in suspension covered with DNA, I essentially have designed an n by n interaction matrix, okay, of attractive interaction strengths, all of which are temperature dependent. Okay, so that's what functionality I get with this kind of architecture. But now to be a good model system, I'm going to need to be able to design what structures I make. And I'm going to do that largely in simulation, okay, or hope my collaborators will. And I'm going to need some sort of empirical potential to describe the interaction caused by these goofy molecules. I need to know that experimentally the system has good kinetics so my students don't have to wait weeks to grow stuff. And then when I make a crystal, I should be able to see what it is. I should be able to do crystallography on it without jumping through too many hoops. And so these are the goals that I'm going to sort of show you that we've realized. And I'm going to require that experiment and simulation should agree in the system, which you'll find out if they do or not. So this is the outline of my talk. It's going to be three parts, each of hopefully a little less than 10 minutes. These are my two students who sort of did the work, both of whom are graduated now. I'm going to start by talking out about these interactions and the dynamics of this interaction between particles, okay, like a potential of mean force, if you will. I'm going to talk about some simple crystals that we made and how we do crystallography on them. And then I'm going to talk about sort of a more complex phase diagram that we've explored and some different structural transitions and transformations that we've seen. So a picture of the experimental system, or a cartoon. This is sort of a plastic sphere made out of polystyrene, and the little fuzz on it is my student's rendering of what a tethered single-stranded DNA molecule would look like. So it's a tethered random walk. Each of our particles has order of a few thousand DNA strands on it, which I think is not what he drew. He drew less than that. And then schematically, what we say is, okay, so we have these red molecules, which are a non-interacting 50-base sequence that's just all T bases. And then there's this terminal sequence, which is complementary over part of its length to its mating blue sequence on the other bead. Okay? And so when these beads come together, I can form a double helix just of these little sticky ends, and that bridges the particles together and exerts a force. So we have two different variations on this that I'm going to talk about. One is we just have plain red and plain blue spheres, and the interaction matrix schematically is, okay, blue sticks to red, red sticks to blue, red doesn't stick to red, blue doesn't stick to blue. Well, now if I want to make something slightly more interesting, well, I can blend the red and the blue together on an individual sphere. So I can make a red-rich sphere and a blue-rich sphere. And then the red-rich sphere and another red-rich sphere will still have a small interaction, but it won't be as strong an interaction as when a red-rich sphere and a blue-rich sphere come together. Does that make sense? So this is just sort of a convenient way of realizing a simple interaction matrix without doing too much DNA stuff. So this is the chemistry. I'll kind of skip over it. So we have a way of sticking the DNA onto a block polymer, and we have a way of grafting block polymers onto polymer particles that involve swelling and deswelling. Doesn't really matter, but we actually had to develop this technology because at the end, the particle is covered in these sort of very non-sticky, stealthy PEG molecules, and that's actually important. So there are no non-DNA interactions that are present in the system that are significant. And most of the bioconjugation techniques out there weren't good enough. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to measure the interactions that we get, and then we're going to make a model to test it. And we measure the interactions using an optical tweezer setup, and all you really need to know about it is that the way we make our tweezer, it looks like a one-dimensional potential, okay? It looks like a one-dimensional potential that's harmonic. I put two particles on it, and they sit there and they bounce back and forth in the trap, okay? And so what that looks like is this. So this is a picture of two 1-micron DNA-covered spheres bouncing around in a trap. And if you look at it closely, it looks like sometimes they're doing this, and then sometimes they're doing that. Okay, so sometimes they're bound and sometimes they're not. And this is a plot of the separation in nanometers between these guys as a function of time. So they spend a lot of time in this low separation state, and they occasionally explore the optical trap and then go back into the low separation state. The particles are free to rotate. I believe they're anchored to a solid surface. Yes. Okay, so this is another plot of a trajectory. So at high temperature, that binding doesn't happen, and they just rattle around the trap. And at low temperature, they rattle around but spend a lot of time stuck. And this is what the histograms look like at different temperatures. And now, you know, we've heard a lot about Boltzmann inversion. Okay, well, this is a very complicated one-dimensional Boltzmann inversion, okay, that I can go from the histogram to the corresponding potential of mean force. And when I put two A-spheres in where there shouldn't be any bridge formation, I get this nice repulsive interaction. And when I put a blue and a red together, I get a temperature-dependent attractive interaction well that looks like that. Okay? So my first task is to try to model that interaction. So the repulsion is easy. That's sort of, you know, there's papers from decades ago about modeling polymer brush repulsion. Now, what I'm going to try to explain to you is that we spent a lot of time thinking about the thermodynamics of this, which is kind of complicated because I have all these reacting tethered polymers. And what I'll say is that this free energy zero, so I'm trying to understand this free energy of the two particles over kT as a function of my data G of R. Okay? And I want to try to model this. And what I'm going to say is that this delta F equals zero reference state is the unbridged configuration. And I can generalize that because that's actually true at all separations H. Okay, so when they're really close together, delta F equals zero at that point corresponds to no bridges. And so if I see some large G of R, it means that it spends most of its time in a bridged configuration. So I can actually formally say that the observed G of R is inversely proportional to the probability there are no bridges. Okay, so if there is, if at a given separation there are bridges only 50% of the time, my G of R will be 2. If my probability of no bridges is 25%, my G of R will be 4. And that's true at all age. So we've reduced the problem to computing the probability that there'll be no bridges between these reacting polymer brushes at a given separation. Now, in reality, the problem of the system is very complex because I have the two brushes, these reacting ends of these two brushes are, have a non-uniform spatial distribution. They're vectorial, so two DNA strands like this will hybridize and two DNA strands like that won't, so that can be complicated. If I don't have a lot of DNA in there, I could have stochasticity. Okay, affecting things. And then this hybrid, this duplex is force sensitive, so if the beads are pulling on it with too much entropic tension, they'll pull it apart. So we designed our sequence and our DNAs to make these three things go away, and you can ask me questions about it if you want. So if you make the DNA long and flexible, you don't need to worry about any of this. And if you go to high density, you don't have to worry about stochasticity. And so all we have to do is account for the spatially non-uniform reacting brushes. And the way we do it is a model that might seem kind of simplistic to you guys. And so we just model each polymer as a tethered random walk. And I believe it has 8 Kuhn lengths. Okay, so we just do 8 random walk steps. We make a configuration and we make a continuous distribution. We then make the same continuous distribution on the other sphere. And then we say that there's an interaction region that we divide into little volume elements, and in each volume element, we solve the equation of chemical equilibrium. So this would make sense if Avogadro's number was infinity. Okay, so we're completely wiping out the idea that these things are molecular. It's a mean field model. Okay, so we solve some sort of reaction network, or a simple just chemical equilibrium, and we can tell you how much of the bridge product, that AB product, will be present in each volume. Then all I have to do is do a little bit of statistics. I can take this, multiply it by Avogadro's number and the volume to get the expectation value of the number of bridges in that box. I can then convert that to the probability there are no bridges in that box using something like Poisson distribution or the binomial distribution. And then if I do some sort of grand product of all of these little guys, I can get the total probability. Okay, done. All right. And good news, it works. So this is a plot of that attractive pair interaction added on to this repulsive interaction as a function of temperature. And the functional form is right. And if I take just the depth of this well and plot it as a function of temperature, those are the circles. And my calculation goes right through it. Okay. This gray band uncertainty is the a priori error of the nearest neighbor model. Okay. So the good news is that we didn't have to fudge anything. Okay, we know almost everything about DNA, so there's no real free parameters. Now, if I go back to the system where I mixed the red and blue strands on particles and I do the same kind of measurement, I get this. And if I take those well depths, they're actually significantly weaker. Okay, they all form at much lower temperatures than what the previous model would suggest. But that's very simple. It's because not all the bridges that form, not all the CAB product actually is a bridge. Some of it's a loop. Okay, if this guy has a reaction which makes a loop, and that guy has a reaction which makes a loop, it doesn't exert any force. So if I just kind of assume that everybody does it stoichiometrically, I can just come up with a simple correction factor, and that works quite well. Okay? So this is sort of a very sort of straightforward, easily implemented way of estimating the interaction potential between these guys. Now, we could also talk about the dynamics briefly. So this wouldn't be very useful if the DNA dynamics were so slow that I couldn't actually build anything. So there's really two variables in this problem, two dynamical variables, and one is the reaction rate. If I put the two particles next to each other, how fast does a bridge form? And the other one is the time for them to diffuse across that interaction well. And the ratio of those is, you know, my chemi colleagues would call that a Dom-Kohler number. And to cut to the chase, in the interest of time, if you go to high DNA density, the Dom-Kohler number is much greater than 1, which means that the kinetics of these things are exactly the same as just two things diffusing in a mean field potential. Okay, so the dynamic time scales of the molecules don't actually enter into the problem. And the takeaway on that is that if I was doing a simulation, I could just write a particle level simulation with this empirical potential, and not only would it have the right thermodynamics, it would also have pretty good kinetics. Okay? All right. So now to move on, I want to talk about some simple crystals and some crystallography. So what we're going to do is one change we're going to make, we're going to go from the 1 micron particles, which are good for optical trapping and making measurements, and I'm going to shrink them down to smaller particles, 400 nanometers in diameter, because for technical reasons, those have better crystallization properties. And I went to my simulation colleague, Talid Sino, some of you might know, and I gave him the potential, and I said, is it going to nucleate and is it going to grow crystals? And so he just did a simple MMC, put a bunch of particles in a box with that potential I showed you, because it is it's a very short range spherically symmetric potential, so it wasn't clear what it would do. And he said, yeah, it nucleates and grows, no problem. It makes random hexagonal close packed. So we went to the lab and my student whipped up a mixture, and this is a one component system where we only have A's, where A sticks to A. And sure enough, all you do is you take the system, you heat it up. At high temperatures, there's no bridges, there's no attraction. You put it in a styrofoam cup of hot water, okay? And then you go get lunch, okay? And then you come back and, you know, your cup of hot water is cooled off. And at some point during that cooling process, the interactions are getting stronger and stronger. You nucleate and grow little crystals, okay? And then you put them under an optical microscope, you see this, which in a zoom in, this is a 100 face of an FCC crystal, and you can see like a step edge and other sort of crystallographic features. Okay? And this looks a lot like what the depletion interaction would do for colloids if you know about the depletion interaction. But what we really wanted to do is something more interesting, like binary alloys. So we made a system where A sticks to B. We did the same kind of, you know, overlaunch experiment with the hot styrofoam cup, and it made crystals look like this. And maybe this looks to you kind of like that last crystal I showed you, but to me, I looked at that and I went, wow, that's really freaky. I've never seen anything like that, because I look at a lot of these. And if you go in and you zoom in, what you discover is that these faces here, okay, these little lines or these little crystals, are not 60-60-60 equilateral triangles. They are in fact 55-55-70 triangles. Okay, and that is what you would expect on a 110 plane of a BCC crystal. And I guess I should tell you that the predicted phase diagram for this system is that it should make a super lattice with a BCC structure, okay, where the A and B occupy alternating sites, just like that first cartoon I showed you on my first slide. Okay. So now, this is a micrograph of what a crystal looks like. The crystal is small enough that the entire crystal has Brownian motion. Okay, I apologize, that's a little bit blurry. You can just kind of see a facet edge there. Okay, so you can see that little triangular edge. Here's another one. And it turns out these guys are slightly sloppy looking rhombic dodecahedra. Okay, and this is what you would expect a BCC crystal to facet like, because the 110 plane is the densest plane, so it's the slowest growing plane. Although with this small number of atoms, or meta-atoms, if you will, there's like step edges and other sort of features. Okay? But now, the bad news is that we said the thing's a super lattice, right? So the A and B alternate, but here I can't tell the difference between A and B because they're all clear. So what I really need to do is to do a little better than that. So during that process where I'm swelling and deswelling my particles to put the DNA and the non-sticky peg on them, I can just throw in some fluorescent dyes. And they'll get incorporated into the middle so I can make them fluorescently tagged. So I make the A's green and the B's red. And then I look at the whole crystal that I make on a confocal. Now this is a picture of what I would normally see. And this is actually a midplane, okay, of a three-dimensional crystallite that was sort of stuck on the glass. And if you look right there, you can see that there's a little dark spot. Okay, and I claim that's a vacancy. So my reviewers gave me a lot of trouble about whether I could actually do this crystallography, so you're going to have to sit through two slides. Okay, so technically, normally when you're looking, doing confocal on colloidal crystals, you have to index match and do all kinds of other stuff. And it works out that in our system, we can actually see the crystal structure in all these different planes. Okay, this is a focal scan through a crystal. And the reason why we can do that is actually because the particles are small enough that the crystals are basically transparent. Okay, so there's this nice little window where if I made the particles really big, I wouldn't be able to see inside because the crystals would be too strongly scattering. But if I make them small enough, the crystals become transparent so I can see inside. If I go a little bit smaller, then I'm below the diffraction limit, I can't see the particles anymore. So I call this Goldilocks confocal imaging. Okay, and it sounds bad, but it's actually pretty easy. All right. So to kind of get to the material science meat of the talk, I'm just on time. We wanted to sort of say, okay, can we explore the behavior of this system, of the binary system, as we mess with that interaction matrix? Okay, so we have a lot of parameters. We have two different particle sizes. We have AB interactions between A's and B's. We have interactions between A's and A's. We have interactions between B's and B's. That's something like five dimensions, okay, if I counted right. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep things simple, and we're going to keep the AA and BB interactions equal, and we're going to make them less than the AB interactions, okay? Because if I make these guys stronger than those, it'll just phase separate into an A crystal and a B crystal. And the way we're going to realize this experimentally is by that blending trick that I showed you in the first part of my talk, that I'm going to put a few reds on the blue spheres and a few blues on the red spheres, and I'm going to characterize how much I put on using this mixing ratio alpha, which I'll mention again and again. So at alpha equals zero, A sticks to B, A doesn't stick to A, B doesn't stick to B, and then when alpha is 50%, then A's and B's are identical, okay, and they interact with each other completely symmetrically. And so I'm going to modulate the relative strength of these so-called like interactions, like attractions, versus these unlike attractions. Okay. So again, I went to my simulation colleague, Talid Sino, and I said, hey, you know, let's put some particles in a box and do some MMC and see what happens. And when you put in small like interactions, oh, lo and behold, it spontaneously nucleates and grows little crystals that have that cesium chloride structure. And if you go to slightly higher like interactions, it grows these little things that are, let's call them CP for now. Okay. And they're a CP superlattice. Okay, so, and here, also for simplicity, we've sort of set the diameter of the two particles to be the same. We can change it experimentally in a simulation, but we haven't yet. Now, the one takeaway from this that's kind of important is that the CP phase does not grow well ordered. Okay, so the crystal ordering is good, but the compositional ordering is poor, which means that it's not alternating A, B, A, B. I get A's in the B spots, and I get B's in the A spots. So it has poor compositional order. And we actually did a whole sort of series of studies on that. And it turns out that when I'm growing a crystallite, on the growing surface, there's growth sites, okay, where A's and B's have to come in to sort of grow the crystal. But it turns out that there's actually a finite attraction between the particles and the wrong sites. Okay, so this binding of particles to anti-sites actually is what leads to this compositional disorder. So that can all be summarized in a phase diagram. Okay, so this is a plot versus this unlike attraction strength in KTs versus the like attraction in KTs, and EBB and EAA are the same. And then for low like attractions, this axis, I just make cesium chloride, BCC, like I said before. But then out here, I make this CP phase, and I can actually show that at this 50-50 line, where everybody's equivalent, it's a random solid solution of A and B. It has an FCC structure, but it's a random solid solution. And then as I move away, I get slightly more ordered, but not very much. Okay, so just to show you a picture of this, this is what that CP structure looks like. So these things are stacking faults, so it's not really cleanly FCC in simulation, and the reds and greens are not all that ordered. Okay, I can define some order parameter, but it's not close to perfect. This is what the cesium chloride crystal looks like, and you'll notice that it looks kind of bent or ripply, and that's because the cesium chloride structure actually has multiple soft or even zero modes. Okay, so you know that, I'm sure you're all aware that you can take a BCC phase and you can shear it. Okay, so entropy does that. Okay, thermal fluctuations cause this thing to kind of like breathe and stretch and slide. And in fact, the only reason why this thing's favored for low interactions, for low like interaction strength, is because it has higher vibrational entropy than this phase. Okay, so that's what actually drives that phase transition. And then if you have defect states, this thing is so perturbable that you can get all kinds of wacky quasi-stable states. All right, so to go to the experiments, these are some micrographs that are slightly cleaned up versions of what I showed you before. This is cesium chloride, and if we make up a sample and we look at a bunch of different crystallites, we find a lot that have this 1-1-0 symmetry like I showed you before. And then this is a zoom in, and here what I've got is alternating red and green on lattice. And we can go in and we can measure all the lattice spacings, and it exactly matches sort of that cartoon to the percent level of what you'd expect for a BCC cesium chloride crystal to look like. And then a subset of them also show this 1-0-0 symmetry, which isn't quite as dense as this phase, but it occurs with some low probability. And so that's all good, that's fine. And then if you go to really strong like interactions, okay, near that solid solution phase, you get crystallites which, when you look in the white light image, they're still perfectly well ordered. I mean, look at that thing, okay? It's beautiful, okay, equilateral triangles. And then when you look at it in composition space, it's random, okay? It's a mess. And so this exactly matches what the simulation told us that we should see. All good. And then in between, we got a surprise. Okay, we like surprises when we're experimenters. And so this is a Z-scan through two different colloidal crystals, which are highly ordered, and we had to scratch our heads for a while, okay, because they didn't match cesium chloride, they didn't match other things that they might have been. And in fact, when we looked more, we found even a third one that I don't have a good movie for. So we found three different appearing crystals. And after scratching our head for a while and doing some drawings in Google SketchUp, we finally decided that they were, in fact, these three facets of one structure, which is FCC copper gold. Okay, so FCC copper gold is an alternating superlattice of FCC. Okay, so maybe that wasn't so surprising that we got that, except you'll remember that the simulations didn't get it. Okay, so this is one of those rare instances where the experiment came out way more ordered than the simulation. Score one for experimenters. Okay, I won't get used to it. So, and then yeah, this thing exactly matches all the geometry. And so there were a couple oddities. Okay, one was that whenever we had, every time we saw this, we also had that. Okay, every time we had copper gold, we also had cesium chloride in the sample. They coexisted in all of our samples. Like we, whenever you had one, you had the other one. It's like they were buddies. And then the other thing that was strange is that the size of the copper gold crystals is always basically the same as the cesium chloride crystals. Okay, and there's no real reason why that would be so. And then if you looked at the faceting of these guys, okay, which are these three symmetries, a couple of these are not dense faces. So if you were growing FCC copper gold, you would never expect like these phases, these faces. So that's just bizarre. So we thought about it for a while. And what we finally figured out, so this is what the distribution of different crystallites looked like. So this axis is that alpha parameter. These are those random solid solutions. This is that sample that makes a lot of cesium chloride. And then we found this whole window where it made tons of copper gold. Okay, but as soon as we switch to random solid solution, we lose both. Okay, they coexist. That's what I told you before. Okay, so now this is the result of a lot of simulation work by my collaborator. And this line is that phase boundary I showed you before, okay? Where this side is that random solid solution and this side is cesium chloride in blue, okay? And this curve delimits what grows when I nucleate it from the bulk. But now if we go back and we then say, okay, what's the free energy of copper gold, FCC, relative to any of these phases, it turns out that it's lower free energy to the right of this dotted line, okay? Thank you. And so thermodynamically, the system wants to make copper gold FCC over here, it just can't get there kinetically by nucleating from solution, okay, because of that anti-site problem. But of course, as we know, you know, nature finds a way. And so what we suggested might happen is that maybe there's a solid-solid transformation. Maybe there's a diffusionless transformation from some structure into FCC copper gold. And so the first thing that we noticed is that these lines are computed phase trajectories for my different samples. Okay, so as a function of alpha and temperature, at high temperature, both interactions are small, and then as I cool, these are the trajectories I take across this phase plane. And so what I noticed is that all of the samples that made cesium chloride and copper gold were from here over. So they all went through this cesium chloride forming phase, okay? And so they would form cesium chloride, and then we hypothesized that cesium chloride could actually transform into copper gold. The best evidence we had for that was we looked, my poor student hunted around. She characterized 400 samples, 400 separate crystallites and solved their structure. And she found seven that had this remarkable property of being two different crystallite phases stuck together. Okay, so this is cesium chloride on this side and copper gold on that side. And then there's this nice sharp linear boundary between the two. Okay, and we have a couple samples where we have three-dimensional data. But the really remarkable thing is that in all these different crystallites that we captured, these seven crystallites, the crystallographic orientations of these two phases and the interface are all identical. Okay, and then this is exactly what you would expect for a habit plane. Okay, if I had a fusionless transformation or a Martensitic transformation between two phases, they typically form a habit plane interface between the two, and then the crystallography of this is what's required to sort of match those two phases together. And so we think this corresponds to the classic Bain transformation, which was mentioned earlier today briefly, for cesium chloride to FCC copper gold. And now the other cool thing is that it solves the facet problem completely, because those weird child facets that we saw in the copper gold crystals actually are just the parent facets of cesium chloride that we saw transformed to the new crystal bases. Okay, so it exactly explained that anomaly too. Now, another cool thing is that these crystals that we make that are copper gold, this sort of property of having nice straight domain walls that are coherent, okay, is the description of this sort of habit plane. That's what shape memory alloys do. Okay, so shape memory alloys are a subset of alloys that undergo martensitic transitions that have this coherent habit plane. And they also have this property of being superplastic. And indeed, we separately noticed that when you take these colloidal crystals and you shear them with the pipette, they don't fall apart, but they get stacking faults. Okay, which is kind of was weird to us, but that's actually what they should do if they were colloidal shape memory alloys. We're excited about that, and we're investigating it further. So I went back to my simulation guy and I said, hey, can you make a martensitic transition happen in these things? So he took some cesium chloride, put it in part of the phase diagram where it should make FCC copper gold, and then lo and behold, it went poof into a CP state. But if you notice, it has all kinds of like little stacking faults in it. Okay, so he was able to see the martensitic transition, but he was not able to get FCC. He was able to get RHCP copper gold. And then we've thought about this a lot, okay, and I'd be interested to talk to you guys about how to think about this. So unlike a regular martensitic transition, this system is completely degenerate in energy with FCC and HCP copper gold. There's like no energy splitting whatsoever. And so what that means is that our system choosing FCC has to be completely a kinetic effect. And as we know, Monte Carlo and Brownian dynamics are not going to correctly capture all the complex dynamical issues going on in the experiment. All right, and with that, I'll go to my summary slide. So I hope I've convinced you that these DNA interactions in colloidal systems make for a versatile and specific model system, that we have a pretty good handle on their interactions and modeling, and that we can make complex ordered structures that are real materials with real behavior. Thank you.
A simple question with respect to colloids.
Yeah.
Do you have any problems with the polydispersity of these colloidal particles, or did you specifically play with the polydispersity of these particles?
These particles, we selected the most monodispersed we could buy, which I think were 2 or 3%. And in other experiments, we saw that if you go to higher polydispersity, it messes things up. So I would say that for these experiments, we have to keep it under 5 or 6% polydispersity, and that's what we did. Yeah.
Really nice talk. I'm thinking about mechanical properties in a different limit. How long have you added very long chains or tethered very long chains and had the interactions at the functional groups at the ends of very long chains?
Yeah, so here the length of the chain is a couple percent of the diameter of the particles. So these things, they wouldn't be really like particles in a gel. They're really much more just like colloidal crystals. But yeah, we have thought about that limit. It's very hard to make the DNA chains much longer.
But could you just add the DNA chains at the tip of a long chain?
How long do you want? You want a micron long polymer chain?
I'll have a think. But I'm telling you why.
Okay.
I think you'll have gorgeous self-healing properties because, and you already have some indication of that. As you pull on it, so I want materials to be sufficiently large that you could do a tensile deformation on it.
Mm-hmm.
As you pull on it, You because you have this beautiful red-blue interaction, as you break one bond, suddenly it'll catch on to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it's like having lots of beautiful labile bonds.
Yes.
Right? As you undergo this deformation, you're reshuffling and you're finding a new pair.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to have incredible toughness, essentially, because material
yes.
is really deformable. So.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that we are doing is we're going to smaller particles. We're going down to the nanoparticle scale, and so then that limit of having many different next nearest neighbor and first nearest neighbor bonds is all true. So we could look at the toughness of the nanoparticle films that we're making.
That I do know how to model.
Okay.
This is a very simple question. Back to the very beginning of the talk, you said that when you put these things on the surface, they're immobile. Or I think you responded to Kurt.
Yes.
In that way, they don't move around at all.
Uh huh.
But the surface concentration is also low enough so that when you do put mixtures of A and B or whatever you want to call them on the surface, you don't get interactions between things on the same particle.
I went through that kind of fast. So that's this correction factor that we applied accounts for that. That we just assume that The system doesn't care about whether it's making a loop or a bridge. It just makes loops and bridges in a stoichiometrically random way. And that's why the interaction here is weaker than it would be if it didn't make loops. But our model accounts for that.
Would it be possible to use this to create colloidal particles with a valency?
That's finite, like 5?
Yeah.
Yes, but they wouldn't be ordered, right? So I could definitely put 5 molecules on a particle. For one thing, they would be randomly distributed on the surface.
Yeah.
Which probably wouldn't be conducive to a lot of assembly. And then another, of course, I would have a binomial distribution, and I would have 4 on some and 6 on another. But maybe you were thinking of something else?
No, I was thinking about, you know, a well-defined valency, but you'd have to have them at specific locations, of course, and with the sizes that you now have, I think it's going to be rather tricky to create like a tetrafunctional
clone. So, I mean, a lot of people, we've thought about that. A lot of other labs are thinking about it, too. It gets kind of technical. Nobody, I think, has any really good ideas. I mean, here we were going to the mean field limit so we could avoid that complexity. You got that already, but that would be great if we could do it.
Okay, thanks.
So the length of the DNA is short compared to the size of the colloids, and that means that this range of attraction is very short.
Yes.
Compared to the size.
Uh-huh.
Am I right in assuming that in this case the only condensed phase you could ever get is a solid? Because, I mean, there's this old thing that you basically eliminate the fluid phase out of a phase diagram if that range is too short compared to the size.
Just from, like, the depletion literature?
Sort of, I mean, yeah, people have studied this for, I mean, why do you
I could believe it. I'm not familiar with that result, mm-hmm. but I could believe it. Again, we can go to smaller particles, and we could imagine getting some sort of three-phase mixture mm-hmm. or some triple point.
But in that case, I mean, since the phase diagrams of these colloidal crystals, or if you have hard spheres with some extra attraction, mm-hmm. the kind of phase diagrams depends then sensitively on what that range is. So I was wondering whether your collaborators also try to match that range, because if they didn't, they might see different phases.
No, our collaborators replicated the thing that we grew
okay.
in terms of particle size, and they used the same brush formula that we used to model this.
Okay.
But they also looked at smaller particles and bigger particles, and the phase boundaries do move around, as you might expect. But there, you know, for small perturbations like factors of 2 or 3, there weren't any other new phases that appeared. I think when you play with the size ratio, then instead of getting a lot of AB type crystals, you'll get ABN crystals. And there's a whole zoology of those that are well known from electrostatics. And they'll be different here because of the short range interactions, and that's something that we're working on right now.
Okay, I have a question about these very interactions of things which hybridize from one particle. If they form kind of a loop on one particle,
yes.
and there can be a loop on the other particle,
yes.
loops can actually temple to one another.
Yes, we could have hypothetically, we thought about how we could topologically bind these, right? So you could make a system that has A and B on one bead and C and D that are complementary on another bead, and you could look at the interactions between those. And that's something we thought about, what we haven't done.
Even if you only have A and B on both, then energetically it may not be important, but kinetically it might still be important.
I think that's right. So I think that this whole formulation that we're using doesn't take that into account. Okay. But in the limit where we are, the kinetics of the molecules are much faster than the kinetics of the DNA. And so I don't think we would be able to observe that topological binding. Okay,
so
in this kinetic limit.
Kinetics of particle is fast compared to kinetics of DNA.
Oh, maybe I said it wrong. So here, the diffusion of the particles across the well is very slow compared to the formation and rupture of single bridges.
Okay.
But we have data in the other limit. So if you go to lower DNA density and you play with the thermodynamics, you can also explore the other limit, and over there we might expect to see topological binding.
I know that Paul Jaikin in his experiments does see, or his students do see, such slowing down of kinetics by this looping.
I've seen that paper, but I haven't replicated the results.
One more. I have an experimental question. When I look at these data, you resolve this thing at a tens of nanometers resolution.
Yes.
Right? When you look at the two light spots at a micron apart, do you correct for interference effect due to the overlap of these, I don't know, airy disks or whatever that's called?
The short answer is yes. We actually use these are non-interference patterns. All right, so the way we set up the optical system, the two particles intensities add rather than their electric fields adding. And so our algorithm assumes that this is a superposition of two intensities. And we set up our light source such that that was a valid approximation.
Your intensities add?
Yeah, so in the, if I use an incoherent light source, then I'll see the sum of intensities rather than the sum of electric fields. And so I played with the coherence of my light source just to facilitate that analysis. And yeah, that was something that, that took a couple of years, a long time ago, to work out.
I have a short follow-up on Marco's previous question, not for recent, but if you take different spheres, where you have red and blue,
yes,
and if you take them off different refractive index, can you use that to construct photonic crystals systematically, or do you then run into trouble with dispersion forces?
I think obviously most of, a lot of the practical interest in these things is to make metamaterials and to use weird materials, but I'm obviously not doing that. I don't know of people talking about the photonic properties of BCCs being particularly favorable. I mean, certainly for years people have been talking about photonic crystals, plasmonic crystals. I think there is a diamondoid. There are diamondoid structures in this phase diagram if you go to very strange places, and we might get to that at some point, but we're letting our simulation people sort of explore that first and tell us that it'll be easy and it will nucleate before we go to the trouble of building it. So yeah, we might be able to form diamond-like phases, and that might be more interesting from a photonic point of view, but it's not really front and center right now.